next week. The book of Numbers has a, at least once the people leave Mount Sinai, there's a number of setbacks, socially, spiritually, and community-wise that occur as they journey forward. And some of them are very devastating. We already saw in last week's Parsha that Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses, slandered Moses. We saw that the people, instead of craving the words that God was giving to those 70 people who were speaking ecstatically at the tabernacle, at the same exact time, the rest of the people of Israel were out wandering, or at least some of them, were out wandering in the desert to collect quail. Their focus, their sight was not in where it should be. In this week's Torah portion, we have the story of the scouts that are sent to Eretz Yisrael to explore the land. And how many were bad? Ten were bad and two were good. Do you remember which of the ones brought back a positive report? Or at least that by the end had a positive. At the beginning, they all said good things, but then it just kind of disintegrated from there. Which two ultimately had the positive report? Do you remember? Joshua and Caleb were the standouts. Joshua was Moses' right-hand assistant, and Caleb was an insider as well. Some traditions link him as being married into Moses' family. Because of this, because of the bad report that the scouts bring back, it infects a distrust in the people. They lose their heart. They have actually spiking fear about the prospect of entering into this place that they've heard scary tales about. They don't think they can do it. And because of this, God reorients the entire plan of redemption history and says, okay, well, then you can stay in this desert for 40 years. It'd be actually another 39-ish years because they'd already been at Mount Sinai for a year. So if you don't want to go in, if you don't want to overcome your fear and your doubt, if you don't want to walk in trust, then stay in the desert. And God said, everyone over the age of 20 who left Egypt would end up dying in the wilderness. The only ones that went into the land then with Joshua were the children and the teenagers that came out of Egypt. To say it another way, when Joshua and Caleb led the people into the land, there were only two people over the age of 60, being Joshua and Caleb. Caleb being the more elder of the two of them. Luckily, though, Those that entered the land did overcome their fear of giants, and God actually won that battle for them, interestingly enough. What paralyzed their parents, they were able to move forward and see God accomplish and achieve. What an amazing story of children pressing forward and having the confidence that binds and restricts their parents. Although in a beautiful way, I'm sure they learned a lot about trusting God from their parents. In the following Torah portion, a Torah portion called Korah, we have another disintegrating story, and then yet more to come after that. There's one challenge after another that happens to Israel once they lose their ability to walk in confidence and trust in the Lord. There's one disaster after another, including one that we'll see later in Numbers that impacts Moses himself. The story in Korah is that there was one of the Levites. His name was Korah. He was from the clan of Kohath. We saw earlier in the book of Numbers that there were three different divisions among the Levites. And each of the family divisions in the Levite tribe had different responsibilities. And one of these families was led by a guy named Kohath, except he has a cousin that's jealous. And a root of jealousy enters his heart. And he not only is jealous, perhaps, of his cousin Kohath, but he ends up being jealous of Aaron and Moses as well. You see, Korah was older than Kohath. Perhaps Korah assumed, perceived, that it should have been himself that was the leader of that division of the Levites. But instead, his younger cousin, Kohath, chose instead. First evidence of a possible root of bitterness and jealousy in the heart of Korah. And as so often happens, it seems that that root of jealousy and anger and bitterness was infectious. It spreads. It grows like a malignancy because it is. It's cancerous. So Korah ends up affecting not only himself with anger and jealousy, but his pride and arrogance spread to his best buddies, other Levites. It also spreads to 250 members of the tribe of Reuben. It's interesting if you reflect on the way that the camp was laid out in their journey in the wilderness, you'll find out that due to their very specific camping arrangements, who was to camp where, you'll find out that the tribe of Reuben was camped right next door to the clan of Kohath. So there was Korah camping next door to Reuben. And so there would be opportunity for dialogue, conversation, gossip, slander, arrogance, to go on. In other words, it is important who your next door neighbors are. It's important to what extent you allow yourself to listen to them and perhaps be infected negatively. Your friends matter that you have, your associates, your neighbors. And this is what Korah said to Moses and Aaron. It says that they gathered against Moses and Aaron. That term in the Greek scriptures, in the Septuagint, that verb to gather is used in the Torah only elsewhere at the golden calf incident. The people gathered to construct this golden calf. It's interesting that here there is another gathering that's going to be equally painful, sad, and devastating. And so Korah and his mafiosos that are with him, 250 of them, tell Moses, "You've gone too far." All of the community is holy, all of them. And the Lord is in their midst. By the way, all three of those statements are in effect true. The entire community is holy. We've already seen that. Talked about that when we were studying through Leviticus. The Lord is in their midst. God said, I will be in the midst of my people. I will be with them. I will guide them. I will be there, go before them. I will be their guard behind them. And indeed, the Lord is in their midst. But as is true with slander, so often truth then becomes attack. Korah says, "Why then do you raise yourselves above the congregation? Why do you take on these things? Haven't we already seen Moses' heart for the people? At Mount Sinai, Moses said, I'll lay my life down for the people. Moses is the most sacrificial one among them. He, in the last Torah portion last week, he was willing to say when there were people that weren't authorized to be speaking by the Spirit of God, Moses said, that's great. I don't have anything to hold. I don't have anything to hang on to. I want them all. I want all the camp to experience this sort of thing. Moses was, as last week's Torah portion said, the most humble person on the face of the earth. But yet Korah stands up and say, why do you raise yourselves above the Lord's congregation? So what is Moses going to do here to avoid this disaster? We've already seen these series of conflicts, struggles, social and spiritual disasters that have happened in the camp before this. What is Moses going to do this time? Just in the last story, they found out that they were going to have to spend 40 years in the desert. And now what is God going to do? What's the discipline going to be this time? And so what does Moses do to avoid social, emotional, spiritual disaster? How does Moses approach this conflict? How does Moses avoid the crisis. So all that is introduction to say, here's my thought. Moses makes a speech in response to Korah. How does Moses take a stand? How does Moses attempt to dissuade Korah on this destructive path that he is on? Not only is Moses one of the most self-sacrificial people in the camp, he's also one of the wisest. Moses has an amazing strategy here for conflict resolution, Moses style. So what does he do? Verse 4, this is number 16, it says, when Moses heard this, he fell on his face. This, by the way, is the first of three times in this very story that Moses is going to be in prayer. Moses goes to God. Moses' first response is to control his own emotions, to control his own desire to put Korah in his place. The first thing Moses does is talk to God. Consistently through the book of Numbers, that is Moses' response when there is a crisis. Prayer. Prayer is discovering God's purpose and intent for our lives. Prayer is more than telling God what you want or what you need. God already knows these things that we're told by another rabbi named Yeshua. God knows what we have need of before we ask. Prayer is an attempt, a practice, rather, I should better say, in our lives to discover what God's purposes is. What does God want? Not what I want, what does God want? And that is what prayer is. Moses falls on his face in prayer. A couple pages later, it's going to be Moses and Aaron both in prayer. It says, then he spoke to Korah and all his 250 mafiosos, saying, tomorrow morning, the Lord will make known who is his and who is holy, and will grant him access to himself. Tomorrow morning, God is going to show us the answer to your question. He will show us who is holy, who has the kind of access that you want, Korah. Tomorrow morning, first step of conflict resolution, Moshe style, is prayer. Number two is a timeout. Moses gives himself as well as Korah as much as a day to consider the path that they have chosen, the destiny that they're beginning to walk down. Again, Moses is not responding out of his own emotions, his own position as the prophet in Israel. He is, like God, not willing that any should perish. So Moses says, I'm not even going to go there right now, Korah. I'm going to give you 24 hours to cool off. I also am going to give myself 24 hours to make sure I don't say anything stupid. Don't we all have that reaction? We respond in the moment when so often we need to follow Moses' style of conflict resolution and give ourselves just simply space and time. He says, verse 6, do this, Korah, you and your band of brothers, take fire pans, and tomorrow, there's that tomorrow again, take fire pans and tomorrow put fire and incense on them before the Lord. And then the man who the Lord chooses will be the Holy One. This is the third step of conflict resolution, Moses style. He says, take fire pans and tomorrow bring them with some incense and fire and bring them to the Mishkan. And you're going to scratch your head and say, what on earth is that about? And what does that have to do with conflict resolution? I'm glad you asked. The only two times previous that this statement about fire pans and incense appears previously in the Torah is in the book of Leviticus. The first time is when two of Aaron's sons, Nadav and Avihu, take fire pans and they offer what the scripture calls strange fire to the Lord. And in that moment, because the fire they have brought is strange fire, there is real fire that comes out from God's presence and destroys them. What did they have in their hand? They had these fire pans with incense and fire on them. The second time that this idea of fire pans occurs in the book of Leviticus is in Leviticus chapter 16. Which is the description of the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippurim, when the high priest, one individual, would go into the holiest place in order to sprinkle blood on the Kippuret, the cover of the Ark of the Covenant, the gold thing that had two sculptures of angels on it. One day a year, the high priest would go into that room behind the curtain, sprinkle blood from a sacrifice for the entire nation, for all the people, for the entire atonement, for the entire nation, up on that lid of the Ark of the Covenant. In his other hand, as he walked behind that curtain, was a fire pan with incense. One hand, he must have been carrying something to sprinkle the blood, and according to Leviticus 16, he also had with him a fire pan of incense. What is Moses doing when he tells Korah to bring your fire pans and we're going to put incense in them and we're going to put fire and we're going to burn some incense? It's not for the purpose of sitting around listening to some New Age music and enjoying the mood with a little glowing incense. He's giving them a warning. This is conflict resolution step number 3 He's giving them an example from history. Do you remember another time somebody brought fire pans inappropriately before the Lord? What happened to them? Remember Nadav and Avihu? He's telling them a story without mentioning the particulars. But they know the story. They know what fire pans are, and they know what's happened before when somebody unofficially brings burning fire pans before the Lord's presence. They also know and understand that these fire pans with incense is something related not to the Levites, but to the Kohanim, to the priest, and even then, to the high priest. He's giving them a historical background example, a history lesson, a remember when kind of example. First, Moses prayed. Second, Moses gave a time out, a halt to the argument. Thirdly, he gave them an example from past history, and he challenges them to consider in the next 24 hours, consider bringing your fire pans with incense. Fourthly, he says, he throws their own words back at them. He says, no, I've not gone too far. You've gone too far. You're the ones that have stepped the boundary. I love this. It's so Jewish. He throws their words back at them. Later prophets would do that. Yeshua did that. Take their words and either for blessing or discipline, the words of the people would be turned, and they, in effect, would be pronouncing their own consequence or discipline. Verse 8. Moses said further to Korah. Moses said further to Korah. Okay. In verses 5 through 7, Moses has been giving a speech to Korah and his 250 buddies. And then verse 8, it says, and Moses also said. And then it continues with another speech through verse 11. If Moses is already talking in verses 5 through 7, and then he continues to verse 11, why does the text say, and Moses also said in verse 8? Why is that phrase necessary? Why doesn't Moses' speech just continue? Why the phrase, Moses continued to say? Here's what's going on. Moses finished his statement of saying, no, you've gone too far, Korah, and he shuts up. In order to listen to what Korah is going to say. How will Korah respond? I believe that right then and there, Korah could have said, okay, you're right, I get it. I understand your reference to Nadav and Avihu. I understand your reference to the high priest, to the Kohanim. You're right, I've overstepped my bounds. And Moses shuts up and waits for Korah to do that. There's a pause in the conversation. He's waiting for Korah to dialogue with him. But when somebody is walking in bitterness and anger, resentment, slander, pride, sometimes dialogue doesn't even seem possible. And this is what Moses found. Moses fifth, or is this fourth? I don't know. Moses' conflict resolution style, Moses gave Korah the opportunity to respond and dialogue. This isn't a one-way speech from Moses. Moses is leaving room to talk things out, to reason together, to have an understanding, to hear Korah's heart, not just his accusations. Moses wants to know where Korah's at, but Korah won't talk. In fact, Korah never speaks another word in the entire story. Not once does Korah say a thing until the earth opens up and swallows him later in the chapter. Korah never says another thing to Moses in the text. So Moses continues, and Moses' tone changes from, "No, you've gone too far," and it changes in verse 8 to a pleading. There's a reaching. It says, "Son of Levi, listen to me. Hear me. Hear what I have to say. Shema, listen, hear me." He changes his tone, and Moses has gotten the silent treatment from Korah, and so Moses changes his conflict resolution strategy to a soft approach. "Listen to me, Korah." What that really means is, let's talk. I think that's number 5. Number 6 is in the same verse. He names Korah. He says, "You're a son of Levi." Or your translation may say, "You're a Levite. Listen to me, son of Levi. Listen to me, oh, you Levite." He is defining and characterizing who and where Korah is at. He's giving Korah substance. He's giving him a platform. He's giving him identity. He's validating Korah. "Listen to me, son of Levi. You're not a nobody. You're of the clan of Kohat. You have tremendous opportunities and duties that you perform every time this camp moves. You have riches that you don't know about, or that you're not even thinking about." It continues. "Is it not enough for you that the God of Israel has set you apart from the community of Israel?" Isn't that enough that you have this special role? God has set you apart and given you access to him. That's amazing. Korah, you have access to God, the God of Israel. You walk into the Mishkan and you carry the very items of worship that the rest of the people only see from a distance and then covered up with seal skins. You have access to God to perform the duties of the Lord's tabernacle and to minister to the community and serve them. You have identity. You have access. Moses is validating Korah as well as attempting to demonstrate to Korah the place where he stands. Verse 10, now that he has advanced you and all your fellow Levites, note that Moses, and this is kind of beautiful, Moses says directly, God just hasn't advanced the Levites. But he first even makes it singular. God has advanced you. God has given you, singular, Korah, as well as your cronies, this special status to do. But do you want the priesthood too? Moses starts to cut to the heart of the issue. Truly, it is against the Lord that you do, and all your company have banded together. It is against the Lord. This is about number seven in Moses' conflict resolution. Moses finally brings God, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, into this discussion. It is against the covenant-keeping God himself that you are making a stand. Korah, please, I plead with you, listen to me. Don't go on this path. Take time and think about this. Unfortunately, verse 12 does not say, and Korah backed down from his purpose and path and intent. Moses instead turns to some of Korah's partners, Dathan and Aviram. It is interesting, Moses evidently won the heart of one person. In verse 1, it said that along with Dathan and Aviram, there was another guy, another one of the Reubenites named On, along with Dathan. But in verse 12, On isn't mentioned. And in fact, On isn't mentioned for the rest of the story. The tradition from the Jewish commentators is that On heard and understood Moses' words and took them to heart. There's also a Midrash, ladies, that his wife helped dissuade him from taking this path. So there's a story of a righteous wife stepping in and saying, you know, I think you should listen to Moses. On isn't there in verse 12. And in fact, doesn't show up for the rest of the story. Isn't among those who suffer the consequences for their choices. I'd like to say that Moses-style conflict resolution will always achieve the purposes that we'd like it to. But it doesn't. It didn't even happen this time for Moses. But I'm struck and I'm in awe by Moses' speech here and what Moses does to draw out the heart of Korah, to prevent a tragedy, to prevent a painful destiny from occurring. In our own lives, when we have conflicts with family members, with coworkers, with neighbors, God forbid, spouses, right? You always get along perfectly with your spouse, right? May in all your conflicts, may you find ways to overcome the conflict. Conflict is not necessarily an evil thing. It's frustrating. It's difficult. What is bad is what comes out of conflict. Moses didn't see Korah's statement as the end. Moses understood that there could be a way to get through, to press through. Moses understood that he was facing a curtain, not a wall. I can push through. I can push through a curtain. I can walk around a tree. This isn't a wall. Conflict doesn't have to mean something bad in our lives. It's an opportunity to see God's presence brought into a situation, which is what Moses wanted to have happen. Prayer, time, a challenge, an opportunity for dialogue through silence, a tender-heartedness, and an identification of the other's value and worth. These are Moses' conflict resolution paradigms for us. I hope you don't have any conflict. But when you do and when I do, I pray that we can see it overcome and see the kingdom of God established in the midst of our conflict. To see that wall that we think we're facing pushed farther out, away. Push that wall away in the conflict. Don't let it box you in. Find a way to use Moses' example to overcome the struggles, interpersonal struggles, family struggles that we have in our life.